Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Who can we trust? Seems there are fewer and fewer answers to that question. We don't have faith in our big institutions, government, banks, media, even car companies, as generations before us did. Trust is still there, just different. Now we trust tech, bots, algorithms, book a room with Airbnb, catch a ride with Lyft or Uber. This hour on Point, who do you trust now? You can join us on air or online. Who do you trust today? Is it changing? More tech? Less people? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now in the studio is Rachel Botsman, a visiting academic at the University of Oxford, author of Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and Why It Might Drive Us Apart. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rachel Botsman, welcome to On Point.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Great to have you in the studio. So tell us what you see happening to trust in our society today.
So I think there's a profound shift happening to trust. On one side of the coin, you've got a massive erosion of faith in traditional institutions. And of course, we see that in government, in media, but we also see in charities and religious organizations. And at the same time, there's a new form of trust rising up, largely enabled by technologies. And that's a type of trust that I call distributed trust.
Distributed trust.
Distributed trust, yes. Yeah. So rather than trust that flows through institutions, it's a trust that is flowing directly towards between individuals through networks and systems. But the individuals, they may not be humans. They may be algorithms or bots.
So it's not trust flowing up anymore. It's not vertical trust. It's horizontal trust, side to side, friends, bots, people online, all that.
That's exactly right. So the idea that the book is based around is that we talk about trust in crisis. And I think it's the wrong narrative, because I think it's more healthy to think of trust like energy. And like energy, it doesn't get destroyed. It just continually changes form. And so this trust that used to flow upwards for a long period in history, whether that was to a CEO, to an expert, to an economist or a regulator, it's now flowing sideways to friends, strangers, peers, colleagues. And there's consequences to this that are both good and bad that we are starting to feel in all different aspects of society.
So before we get to all that, why do you think trust in those big institutions, government, church, banks, media that you mentioned, why do you think it's collapsing or has collapsed so dramatically?
So what's interesting is that if you look at the surveys, so you can look at Gallup, Ipsos, Reuters, they're all saying the same thing. And that's that trust in institutions at all-time historic low. And I'm not so interested in things like government, because trust has always been low in government. It's institutions that are experiencing the sharpest decline, which is actually in the media. And what I've seen in my research is that it comes down to three kind of entwined reasons. The first, and I think most important, and this is where we feel a lot of anger and frustration and disenchantment, is around a lack of accountability. So how can it be that people in power can keep things hidden? How can it be that people in power and leaders can do something wrong and there aren't serious penalties? So you see this in everything from, you know, the Equifax data breach to the Volkswagen scandal to the financial crisis.
The Catholic Church.
No. And there's two things going on. One is, you know, the breach of trust itself, but then keeping things hidden, that's a real enemy to trust. But then what it does is it further erodes people's faith. It further erodes people's confidence in the system, because if no one is punished, if there are no penalties, how can you believe that the system has really changed? And, you know, there's always been breaches of trust, but what has become really systemic is that institutions, the very fabric of society, is starting to lose their legitimacy. And that is very worrying.
So this new recipe for trust, this distributed trust that you referred to, is emerging now. And you say it's accountability based. What do you mean by that?
So the distributed trust. So the distributed trust is, it's accountability based in probably the way many people think of it is, so the last time you booked a restaurant or the time you bought a book, you may be influenced by a rating or review. So it's this idea that friends or online communities can have more influence than traditional influencers. And this is what we call, this is the second reason why trust is breaking down. It's the inversion of influence. And this can be a positive thing because it democratizes who has voice. So it doesn't have to be more elderly white gentlemen, say. But it's also a dangerous thing because it creates a trust vacuum. And when there's lots of different voices and there's lots of information, it can become really hard to know who to trust. You know, I see this in my day-to-day life where you've got this flood of information and someone is really influential with a following, but you don't know whether you should really trust what they're saying.
Mm. So most of the technology we use then, to that point, most of the apps we use rely on ratings to build trust, right? I mean, on Uber, you rate your driver rates you. Mm. Here is an Uber announcement from September. It's a new rating feature available to drivers. Here's NBC's Savannah Guthrie explaining that.
Starting soon, apparently you will know which driver gave you a poor rating and why. Oh, Uber is unveiling a new feature that will tell you when a driver claims your behavior was not acceptable. Mm. Some of the reasons the driver can cite: wait time, patience, attitude. That covers a lot.
And here's the co-founder and chief product officer of Airbnb at a TED Talk from 2014 describing the hurdle that Airbnb had to overcome in trust during its launch.
We sat back and we waited for the rocket ship to blast off. It did not. No one in their right minds would invest in a service that allows strangers to sleep in people's homes, because we've all been taught as kids, strangers equal danger. We were aiming to build Olympic trust between people who had never met. Could design make that happen? Is it possible to design for trust?
So there were two huge success stories with regard to trust, right? Uber and Airbnb. Trust goes both ways.
It does. So it's funny. My first book that I wrote 7 years ago now, it opened with Airbnb. And I remember the editor saying, you shouldn't open with this company because this idea is going to completely fail. And I said, look, it's really hard to see right now. And I know this idea of strangers, you know, sharing their homes with another seems really risky. But technology is really going to transform the way we can trust people because, you know, these ratings and reviews, I think we'll look back and laugh at them. You know, we'll say, oh, you got in a car with a total stranger based on a 5-star review. And how many times, you know, you give me 5, I give you 5. They're quite clunky mechanisms. But what technology does is it reduces the unknown about a complete stranger. And it gives us enough information to take what I call a trust leap. And so if you think of Airbnb, the way people used to travel is that they trusted a corporate brand, whether it was Hilton or Marriott, and they trusted that because there would be someone when they check in and it would be clean and it would be consistent. And now what we're seeing is that people will trust a listing from a total stranger based on these reviews and ratings.
So how do tech companies view trust? Do they view their users as people who are placing trust in them? I mean, does that view how change how they view themselves, their role?
It's a great question. There is no one answer to it. And I think what I find fascinating and slightly worrying is that they all view it differently. So some of them, you ask the question of where does trust really lie in your platform? And they will sort of say, well, it doesn't lie in us, the company, the corporate brand anymore. It doesn't really lie between the users. It lies in the technology. And the funny thing is, when you talk to users, you'll sometimes hear the same thing. Others see themselves more like community stewards, and others take it even one stage further, that they're kind of like the new institution. And so that they have two roles, that they have to reduce the risk of bad things happening, but they also have to be there when things go wrong. And the really important thing is the new dynamic is it's not just protecting the consumer or the user, you also have to protect the provider. And we're seeing this with the whole future of work, and how do you protect both sides of the market is a really tricky question.
So it's interesting, this new model, the horizontal model of trust, instead of saying trust us up, you know, they say, don't take our word for it, take their word for it, take the rating of our customers' word for it.
Yeah. So it's, you know, and the reason why this is so significant, so profound is that for 200-300 years, it's been the corporate brand or the institution itself that has carried our trust. And so we haven't had to trust other people. And what I find interesting is that users, you like the idea of empowerment. You like the idea of directly trusting other people. But then, of course, when things go wrong, who do we blame? Who is accountable? What is the new social safety net? And this is why I think we're seeing a lot of chaos and disruption, is because this new form of trust has risen up, because it's what technology inherently wants. Technology always wants to take concentrated hierarchical forms of power and to decentralize it. But we haven't reinvented the rules of trust. And Airbnb really is an anomaly in that they have a chief trust officer who was former deputy director of the CIA, a wonderful guy called Nick Shapiro. And he is responsible for really thinking about how trust works, how it's embedded across the organization. But this isn't normal. There's not many people in organizations, and their job is to protect trust.
Mm. And online trust, you say in your book, changes our behaviors, makes us more accountable.
Mm.
In what way? You tell the story of always hanging your towels up at an Airbnb.
I do. I mean, I think the interesting thing is we do criticize, you know, we worry about inflated ratings, rightly so, fake ratings. We see this on TripAdvisor and so on. But they do modify our behavior. And we're just in the early stages of seeing how these online ratings can actually make us more accountable in the real world. So the story I tell in the book is that I stay in both hotels and Airbnb and other platforms. And when I stay in a hotel, like, I just leave the towels on the floor. I don't think about it. And maybe one too many towels I'm guilty of leaving. I don't know why I do that at home. I have one towel and then I end up with three in a hotel. And I would never do that on an Airbnb because I know that I'm going to be rated as a guest.
We are discussing trust in society today and how technology has changed everything. Rachel Botsman is my guest. Her new book is Who Can You Trust? I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point.
So come on and let me know.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about trust this hour, where to find it today, and how technology has changed everything with regard to trust. You can join the conversation. Have you rented your home or a bedroom to a complete stranger using Airbnb? Jumped into a car using Lyft or Uber? Entered your credit card into a fill-in-the-blank website? What made you trust that person, that website, that company? Rachel Botsman is with me in the studio this hour, author of Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and Why It Might Drive Us Apart. Here's some sound from a 2016 video, some bartenders sharing how Yelp has changed their business.
Yelpers, these are our audience. These are our customers, and you know, we work for them. You know, they pay the bills.
And that's kind of, you know, a really great, you know, teaching moment for your staff to say, listen, you're always on, and people have the ability to broadcast that when you're not.
Those ratings mean everything. To this point, let's get Mike in here from Rapid City, South Dakota. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. My wife actually owns a rock shop, a store, sells jewelry and the like in Hill City. Is a very tourist-based area. So we rely pretty heavily on those user ratings, TripAdvisor, et cetera. And I was wondering for Rachel how, if she has any insights to how people sort of weigh, or the consumer weighs, like, say, one or two bad reviews with 20 or 30 great reviews, and the impact that a few negative reviews might have on businesses and trusting individual services.
Good question, Mike. Thank you.
It's a really great question, and it's a huge problem because, as we know, angry people
are very motivated to say what they feel.
Yes, Mr. Miserable. And we don't know what their motivation is, right? They could be a competitor. It's mm-hmm. funny. And so, you know, how do you not bury those reviews, but how do you counter those reviews mm-hmm. is a really big problem. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, you should be worried about them because they can actually destroy particularly a local business. I think what we're going to see, and we're starting to see this, is that reviews become more weighted. So it's not just the latest review that rises to the top. It's that you get a general sentiment around the business or the book or whatever it is that's being reviewed that actually reflects the sentiment of the crowd. So I see this on my own book, right? Like you can have lots of positive reviews and then it's so annoying because the one that has something mean to say is right on the top. Mm-hmm. So it's not practical advice, but I do think it's coming.
And who weights those? How would that practically work?
Well, it would be an algorithm. So you have to trust the algorithm. But it would actually, we're already there in that there's, you can look at the language and the semantics and the sentiment and get sort of an overall review. I would say to your wife, you know, it's interesting. Don't be afraid to ask. When someone's had a positive experience in the shop, ask them to write a good review because they are the harder. The people who have a good experience tend to walk away and not think about it. And there's nothing wrong with saying, if you want to support a local business, please could you write a review?
I want to ask you about how you know who you can trust. And in the age of a president whose rallying cry has been fake news, how that has changed or eroded trust. Here's a montage put together by CNN of how President Trump attacked the media, playing off people's distrust of the news. This is during the campaign.
Do we all love the media? Do we love the media?
No, there's great dishonesty, unbelievable dishonesty in the media. Unbelievable.
Such bad reporting. They're so bad. They're so illegitimate. They are just terrible people. They're scum. They're horrible people.
Will you speak to that, Rachel Botsman?
I'm rubbing my head. My stomach turns every time I hear this stuff because, as I said, you know, the media has experienced a 16-point decline in trust. That's huge. And, you know, I hate to say it, he's very clever in what he's doing. I saw this in Brexit. There were similar voices, Nick Farage, Michael Gove. And, you know, when you start saying, don't trust people, it creates a vacuum. It creates a very dangerous vacuum. And what rises up in this vacuum, unfortunately, is conspiracy theories. What rises up in this vacuum are people that know how to speak to our feelings over facts. And, you know, I think one of the things that we missed about Trump is that he represents a very intoxicating form of transparency for many people. And this is where the media landscape, not just the traditional media landscape, but the social landscape becomes very dangerous because what happens is you go online and your fears are verified, your anger is amplified, and then this cycle of distrust continues. So it's very smart in terms of what he's done in terms of attacking the media because then people become really confused as to who to listen to, who to actually trust, who to go to find the truth from.
So if you're a consumer of news or a consumer of any product, fill in the blank, where do you go to find the truth? If you're hearing that fake news or bad this, you know, dangerous that.
Yeah. So the first thing I say is I wouldn't and I don't consume my news from Facebook anymore. More than two-thirds of American adults, that's their primary source of news, is from Facebook. So the first thing I'd say is actually go to the source. So if you want to read the New York Times, go to newyorktimes.com. The second thing I'd say is, you know, if we want news that we can trust, we have to pay for it. If we want newsrooms with fact checkers and professional editors and trained journalists, we need to start paying for that content because there is no, this is a business model problem.
And it's not cheap.
And it's not cheap. So that's the second. And then I think the third thing is don't just read one thing. Read a variety of sources. The Washington Post now has a blue column and a red column. And I think that's really interesting, where you can read two different points of view on the same issue.
You know, there's been a big backlash for tech companies, especially in the wake of the 2016 election. You mentioned Facebook and getting news. Two-thirds of adults use Facebook as their source of news. I mean, when it comes to fake news, ground zero, right? Right there. So Google and Facebook joining an effort called the Trust Project. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, and the first thing I think to say about fake news is what I would say is, if you want to help break this cycle of distrust, do not use that term, right? Like that term in itself, like it's a huge broad range. So what Google and Facebook and Vox and a few other media publications have come together to form an alliance. It's not perfect, but it's a starting point. And what they're agreeing on are trust indicators. So there's five of them, but what are things that are really important for the consumer to know to actually trust that story or trust that piece of information? So the first being the most obvious is, what is factual reporting and what is opinion? And that these things should be really clearly marked, so you know when you're reading an opinion piece. The second is, who is the source, the original source? So is this a second, third-hand story? How is this article or this piece of news, how is it paid for? Is it sponsored content? Who is the news channel, who is the journalist, and so it goes on. And so the way to think of it is, you know, like you have spell check and it brings to life all your spelling errors. I think what's going to happen is it will be like a filter on your computer where you can see these trust indicators appearing over digital content, and then you have the tools to actually make a better decision.
Let me get Wes in here from Nashville. Hi, Wes. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for bringing up this issue. This is a top item on my sadly long list of concerns in the Trump era. A prime example of technology undermining faith in institutions is the anti-vaccination movement that has used social media to spread its bogus narrative that vaccinations cause autism or that foregoing vaccinations is somehow safer for children. But consider this. Just a few years ago, there were fewer people more trusted than the family doctor. But now social media technology gives a tiny minority a viewpoint, a megaphone that's as big as the majority. Consumers are given a false narrative that there are two equal sides in every scientific argument.
It amplifies one side over the other. Mm. Yeah, Wes, thank you very much.
Yeah, no, I actually write about this. You're spot on in your observation, because it's one of the examples I use in the book. And it's really interesting if you actually go back to the original article that was written, I think it was in The Lancet, from a doctor. And the thing I found so frightening when I dug into that is that it turns out he was sponsored by the lawyers that were in a case against the pharmaceutical companies, a child that had developed autism after a vaccination. So it's like you can't even trust the motivation of that doctor writing the article. But I think you're right. And, you know, and as a parent, I hear this with my friends. She'll remain nameless, but her child was sick. And I said, I think you need to go to the doctor. And she said, oh, no, I looked it up on Mumsnet. And I was like, with all due respect, right, like, maybe what to feed your child for dinner you look up on Mumsnet, but you go to the doctor. And so this is what I mean about some of the negative consequences, is that this inversion of influence, who has become an expert. You see this with the food bloggers, right? The clean food bloggers that have no nutritional training, and they have this massive following, and they're telling young girls to eat bananas or potatoes for a month. So how we actually distinguish between people with influence and people with real knowledge and expertise that we should listen to, I think, is a real issue of our times.
You write in your book, Who Can You Trust, that for a long time, trust was built around tight-knit relationships. And then in the mid-19th century, society went through a tremendous amount of change, and people put their trust into black box systems of authority, right? Things like legal contracts and insurance and regulation. And what happened after that? Where'd it go from
there?
Yeah,
so the reason why I think we're experiencing so much change is, if you look the history of trust, which I promise you is really interesting, it's only ever evolved in two chapters. So you were talking about local trust when we lived in villages, and then the Industrial Revolution, mass migration, institutional trust. And I'm not saying, like, they will still exist, right? We still have people who trust one another in communities. But what's happening is we're starting to realize that this institutional trust that is largely taken on faith, blind faith, that sat behind closed doors, opaque walls, and really resided in the hands of the powerful few, it just wasn't designed for the digital age. And so many of these behaviors, many of these cultural problems that have existed for a very long period of time, we're seeing through them, and we're finding out about them. And at the same time, you've got these new forms of trust rising up, whether it be through things like the blockchain or through artificial intelligence or through the reviews and ratings that we've talked about, that in a weird way are taking us back to trusting one another without these institutions, but just it can be anonymous. It can be with strangers. It can be with people on the other side of the world, not my next door neighbor.
So as you were speaking, I was thinking the digital age has changed everything with regard to trust. Does that bleed over then into our interpersonal relationships? I mean, how does that change the way we actually interact one-on-one, face-to-face?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I think when people start to initially think about this issue, they think of it as a macro level. And then you say, well, how has it influenced your relationship with employees? How has it influenced maybe your partnership or your marriage? And so I know it sounds like a trite example, but even the ability, I don't do this, but to check your partner's messages or to check their email, it's giving rise to behaviors that are actually distrusting. So a lot of people say they have a very open, transparent relationship, but it's actually a low trust relationship because there's this need, this culture of like constant surveillance, this need to know where everyone is and what they're doing.
In a 2015 interview with the World Economic Forum, Jack Ma, who's the founder of Alibaba, said that e-commerce is really all about trust.
Today in China and in the world, people don't trust each other. The government and people and media and everybody think, this guy is cheating. But because of e-commerce, we finish 60 million transactions every day. People don't know each other. I don't know you. I send products to you. You don't know me. You wire the money to me. I give a person a package. I don't know him. He took something to sew across the ocean, cross river, and send. This is the trust. We have at least 60 million trust happening every day.
So tell me about Alibaba, Rachel Botsman, an incredible business model based on trust and why it's so successful. I think you said 60 million transactions every day.
I think it's even double now. It's phenomenal. Jack Ma in itself, like I loved researching the story of Jack Ma. That wasn't his original name because how he did this, but he did this in China. And, you know, he was on a trip and he met Stuart Brand, who showed him the internet. And he didn't know what the internet was. And it's a wonderful story where Stuart said, like, so what do you want to look up? And he said, beer. And German beer came up and American beer came up and there was no Chinese beer. And that's how that gave him the insight to start an online business. But
so the business is what?
Oh, so sorry, I haven't described what it is. It's like eBay. It's like Amazon. It's huge. It's absolutely, imagine those two companies combined with a bank. So they have what they call Tmall under the Alibaba brand, which is basically where brands like Disney and Burberry, whatever it is, sell to Chinese markets. But then like on eBay, they have millions of small or individual entrepreneurs or sellers selling to the Western world. And, you know, what is extraordinary is they have done this in a climate like China where, you know, talk about interpersonal trust, close circles of trust. And I think it's extraordinary that they've taken these sellers that often have like weird pseudonyms and they've given them a market to the rest of the world.
You talk about China. I mean, we rate and review a lot of interactions here, but China is using a citizen trust score of sorts, a social credit system. Tell us about that, how it's taking what we do to a whole new level.
Well, I'm sure many listeners have watched. Do you watch Black Mirror, the series? So there's an episode called Nosedive. So if it's a series, an episode where the whole world is constantly rating each other and your score has enormous influence on everything from the type of apartment you can get, the where your kids can go to school. And so I started researching this around 2014 when the Chinese government put out a policy document saying that by 2020, every citizen in China was going to have a social citizen score. And it was really interesting sort of documenting this because their rationale, it sounded very logical on paper. It was an economic rationale that you have a high instance of fraud and counterfeit goods. Many people in China do not have traditional credit histories. So these gold standards of trust that we have in the West are missing. But something didn't smell right. And what they did was they issued commercial licenses to what they call BAT in China, which is Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, the big data companies. And now it turns out that it's not going to just be like you defaulted on a loan. It can be everything from the things that you buy online and whether
your purchasing patterns.
Your purchasing patterns. So, but
things you say on social media.
Things you say, not just things I say on social media, but if you said something on social media and we were connected, my score would go down.
Wow.
And it's amazing. And they got people to buy in because they had these great rewards like VIP check-in at the airport and fast track to a visa. But now they've just announced the penalties. So more than 6 million Chinese have been banned from taking planes. If your trust score dips to a certain level, you can't apply for jobs. Kids can't go to certain schools. You can't get loans.
We are talking about trust and the evolving notion of who and how we hand it over. We're going out here with Taylor Swift. She knows how important reputation is. It's a big theme on her latest album, Reputation. Here's the song Endgame. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. There's more after this break. This is On Point.
Big reputation, big reputation. Ooh, you and me, we got big reputations. Ah, and you heard about me. Ooh, I got some big enemies. Big reputation, big reputation. Yeah.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the great shift in trust and how technology has changed who and how we trust. You can join the conversation, listeners. Do you think we trust technology too much? How should big institutions go about regaining trust? Is that even possible? Rachel Botsman is with me in the studio this hour, author of Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and How It Might Drive Us Apart. Rachel, you mentioned Black Mirror before the break. Here's one of the episodes from the Netflix sci-fi series. Black Mirror society runs on social credit, on a social credit system. Everyone rates each other based on every interaction. Lacey, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, is trying to book a plane ticket in order to get to her friend's wedding. The airline stewardess tells her she no longer qualifies for the only available seat after her score went down 0.02 of a point on her way to the airport.
I see there's one standby seat on another plane leaving tonight. That's reserved for members of our Prime Flight program. You got to be a 4.2 or over to qualify.
Oh, I'm a 4.2.
Mm-mm. I'm afraid you're actually a 4.18. Three.
Oh. Well, that's not my fault. Some woman dinged me down in the cab drive. Can't you just...
I'm sorry, it won't let me book it without the correct ranking.
So, Rachel Botsman, China will have a mandatory social credit system in, 2020? Mm. The system's in pilot mode now, voluntary now. Do you see that sort of thing expanding beyond China?
I do. I mean, I don't think... in the West, I pray that we will not let the government run this type of thing. But the thing that surprised me the most writing the book was really two things, and they're linked. Is one, how easily we give our trust away because of lopsided trade-offs. And, you know, I'm guilty of this. Like, I was signing up to some social account, and it was like, we need your contacts. We need your geolocation. We need access to your friends. And I was like, I'm going to give them all of this for some, you know, small benefit. So... and then sort of, I don't know whether it's apathy or ignorance, and I don't mean that in a judgmental way, because I felt the same way in terms of how much companies and governments are tracking our whereabouts, how much they know about us. And so I think it's really easy to point the finger at China and not think about what's actually going on in the West. And you could argue that the system in China, at least they're transparent around what, I know it's a weird way to use that word, but transparent about what their intentions are, whereas, you know, all this data on us is being used in ways that we don't even know and we extract very little value from.
Let me get Eric in here from Watertown, Massachusetts. Arik, are you there?
Hi, Jane. Yes.
Hi. Welcome.
My question for Rachel was in regards to a story she told at her talk last night about her daughter and Amazon's Alexa. And basically, it was sort of an experiment of how her daughter interacted with Alexa. And by day three, Alexa was suggesting fashion for her daughter. And I find that sort of experience kind of frightening, where here a child is learning how to dress from a machine and not learning organically on her own. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So I was, just to share the story briefly, I wasn't experimenting on my children. Let's just be clear. I was testing.
It's a natural progression of what these kids do with this technology.
Dear Gracie is 3.5, and I wanted to see how she responded to Alexa, the Amazon Echo. And I was telling the audience how she did, you know, she did normal things like she wanted it to play music and she wanted to know what the weather was. She figured out she could order things on the second day. So she ordered lots of blueberries. And then the third day was very significant because she came down the stairs and she usually says good morning to me and her brother, but she said good morning to Alexa and she asked Alexa what she should do today. And then she asked Alexa what she should wear. Now, what I did not tell her is that Alexa has a camera as well. So she doesn't just hear you, she sees you, and there's a style check algorithm. So if Gracie had stood in front of it in two different outfits, so she wears ridiculous outfits, it would have given her a rating and told her which one to wear. And then it would also recommended, like, you know, she was wearing Menke trainers, that does she want a new pair of trainers? And the reason why I shared the story is I think it's so significant in that two things. One, which I find very frightening, is how our trust in technology is shifting from technology deciding, doing something for us, to it deciding something for us. But children, even adults, don't have the ability to discern the intentions of that algorithm. So it's no coincidence that Amazon's just launched a fashion label while it has this new helpful style check algorithm. And so I think this is a really, you know, as a researcher, it's a fascinating question, but as a parent, it really concerns me in terms of what will happen to her capacity to make decisions as a human? And if she starts to outsource her trust to algorithms, what happens when trust breaks down in a relationship? Like, will she have the tools? Will she be able to navigate the world in terms of rebuilding this trust?
So our kids are going to grow up, you know, they're going to be surrounded by autonomous agents, right? Bots. They feel differently about machines than we do. So what's the answer to your question? What happened to your daughter? How do we give these kids the skills to analyze who or what should be trusted?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of pressure is put on schools to solve this problem. This is what I've heard. But just from raising kids, I've got a 6 and almost 4-year-old, I've seen that the window to educate them is really small. Like, it's almost too late with my 6-year-old son. And so I think one of the most important things that we need to be figuring out as this generation is how we teach the children to be in control of the technology versus the technology controlling them. And it's so hard to do when you take your children out and everyone's on their phones. Or I do it and I walk in the house and I'm on my phone. Or they watch Netflix and Netflix knows them. And, you know, it's not that you can shield them from that world, but it is a huge parenting challenge.
Let me get Deborah in here from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I find this conversation fascinating. And one thing that I thought of was, it's just a brief observation that in a world of faith, which was certainly would have described the Western world for a good long period of time, the idea that we were accountable to an all-knowing God kept people reasonably honest. Mm-hmm. They had some reason to believe that they were being watched. And I find it interesting that now we trust the Internet. And I find it interesting that we trust the Internet so much in a time when we know now that Russia has manipulated the Internet through social media for political gain. Mm.
Deborah, thank you. It's a great question. How does faith play into all this? How does it change in our changing world of trust?
Deborah, you are extremely insightful because, you know, when you're writing a book, you suddenly go down this rabbit hole where you'll realize you're writing a whole different book. And I started to research faith because I think where we place our faith, what we feel allegiance to, is actually connected to this erosion of trust. And that, again, like, there is this vacuum around, you know, I think of my grandparents, they had allegiance to their synagogue. And you're right, religion played a really important role. They went to their rabbi when they had a question. They had allegiance to their local community and the shops that they knew. they had an allegiance to a much closer circle of friends that was about when they got together, often on Friday nights for dinner. And so is this somehow connected to sort of a looser fabric of society where you don't have those strong sort of pillars of faith, so you become more influenced by fragmented voices? I don't have the answer to that question, but it's a hunch, and I think she's right.
Deborah, thank you. Here's Robert in Westville, Florida. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the program with Rachel Botsman.
Greetings, Jane. The language of finance is full of borrowed religious terms, such as fiduciary and trust. We use money and legal contracts because we can't trust each other. Settlement is necessary at the point of purchase. Then who can I trust?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I experience the divine as holy integrity, the only one in whom I can put my trust. And I'll take my comments offline.
It's funny. I was looking. Please don't hear this the wrong way. I'm not saying. I was looking at the dollar note, and you know how it's in God We Trust over the White House. And I, you know, the irony of this, that, you know, here's us placing our faith in, he's absolutely right, that you know, money is nothing without trust. And we introduced money. It was a very early trust leap that society took when we went from bartering, which there was a high degree of trust that you have something that is equal or value, or that I needed it, introducing an institutionalized system of value. So money is nothing but the faith that we place in the financial system and the paper itself.
Tell us about blockchain and how that helps, how it works.
So blockchain is one of those things that, trust me, like in a few years' time, you won't care how it works. It's like the internet. You don't need to understand the inner workings of it. But most people would have heard of blockchain in the same sentence as Bitcoin. So Bitcoin being the cryptocurrency. And so what the anonymous creators did was they created a digital ledger underneath that meant that money no longer had to flow through the banks. It could be transferred directly between individuals in a network. And the interesting thing that happened is people sort of decouple the blockchain from Bitcoin and are experimenting all different ways. So there are private blockchains, and these are the things the banks are actually developing because it's a really efficient way to transfer value between people. But there are also public blockchains that are, it's still an experimental phase, but I think it's going to hit really fast, that if you have something of value, it doesn't have to be money, it could be a house, it could be a piece of artwork, anything really, and you wanted to trade that with me, we could transfer that asset directly onto the blockchain without the need for intermediaries.
So let me shift gears a little bit here. I want to get the story in that you tell in the book about your nanny. Early on in your life, you had a nanny who turned out to be not so trustworthy. I want to get this in. Tell us.
Yes, poor dodgy nanny. Not poor nanny, poor parents, I should say. Because so when you become really obsessed with a topic, you sort of start to wonder where this fascination has come from. And I realized it has started when I was five, when Mum went back to work and she hired this nanny called Doris. And Doris, She looked the part, you know. She belonged to Salvation Army, so she wore the uniform and she had this very friendly Scottish accent and these big glasses, big curly hair. And the amazing thing is she came to us and she lived with us for 10 months without my parents suspecting anything. And she disappeared one day. And my parents then started to worry about where she'd gone. So they went round to our neighbor's house. They were called the Luxembourgs, and our nannies were friendly with one another. And he said, "Oh, it's so funny that you've come round, because we've discovered that your nanny and our nanny are running one of the largest drugs rings in London." And so my parents then, they never went into her room, but they went into her room and searched her room, and they found all kinds of stuff in her room. And then a few days later, they came around and arrested my dad, because she wasn't a member of the Salvation Army, but she had robbed a bank and used our silver family Volvo estate as a getaway car. And so, you know, I think I turned out all right. So it didn't really damage me as a person. I do like to remind my parents of this story just to make them feel a bit guilty. But the reason why I found it such a fascinating story is I thought, what is it? How could they have made such a bad decision about to trust someone with their children? And how could they have been dupe for such a long period of time. And what I realized, which I think replies to society today, is that they thought they had enough information to make a decision about her. But the illusion of information is far more dangerous than ignorance. And so there was actually this massive trust gap. And so I started to think about, would they make a different decision today?
And the difference between trust and trustworthiness is important to note.
It is. It is. And so one of my pet peeves is when people say, we need more trust in society, or how do we rebuild trust? Banks ask this question all the time. How do we rebuild trust? You don't want more trust in Dodgy Doris, right? You don't want more trust in President Trump. What you want is you want people and you want systems that are more trustworthy. And the good news is there is science, hardcore science around what makes people and organizations trustworthy. And there's four traits. The first is competence. The second is reliability. The third is benevolence. And the fourth is integrity. And I think, and this is my personal opinion, is that this last piece that really is key, which is about what are my intentions and do my intentions align with mine, being honest about our motives. And when you think when trust breaks down, it's usually on that integrity piece.
And so will people's trust in their online interactions, at least, their work, their shopping, their social interactions be strengthened or diminished, do you think, over the next 10 years, given the trajectory that you've studied?
I think people are going to become smarter about making decisions online around who to trust. So, when you look at, if you think of those four traits, what people are often judging people on at the moment is on the how, the competence, the reliability piece. So you think of Amazon. Amazon is a really good example of this, right? People say that they trust them because their packages deliver on time, but I don't trust them to pay taxes. And so they actually fall down on the why side of the equation. And this is something I feel really passionately about. And I've started to think more about it, because if we want a more trusting society, if we want a higher level trust society, we vote with our purchases. And I think we just let convenience trump trust.
And as a last note, you say in the book, we should all take a trust pause before deciding who to put our faith in.
Yeah, I don't think we should all become less trusting, but I think we need to slow down. And I think we need to ask better questions and seek the right information to decide whether this person or this thing or this piece of information is worthy of our trust. And each time we do that, we're actually trying to preserve what I think is a very fragile and precious asset.
Rachel Botsman, author of Who Can You Trust? How Technology Brought Us Together and Why It Might Drive Us Apart. You're heading back to Australia tomorrow, the last day of your tour here.
But I get to see my children. I'm very sorry.
Well, we appreciate you stopping by to be with us today. Thank you very much, Rachel. Continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the case for why Bob Dylan matters. And sign up for our On Point email newsletter with show highlights and extras that you won't find anyplace else. You can find a link to sign up on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.